Session number 24825, room 9.
This is the fifth reel of a taped interview with Arthur Leggett in Perth, Western Australia, on the 10th of the 2nd, 2003, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Arthur, on the end of the war, on your return to England, were you in a hurry to get back home to Australia?
Not particularly. For reasons which I think I may have outlined, I had a lot of relatives there who were names to me up until this point. I had written to my mum and my sisters and brother at home, told them I was in good health and exactly where I was, and I wasn't going to rush home because I wanted to spend time with these relatives of mine who were rather magnificent people in their own style of living, which was rather different to the way we live in Australia. When we first came to Eastbourne, we were put in little reception groups. Now, the reception group, when men arrived, had to have administration. They were looking for telephone operators, and I had I suppose you call him a bosom mate at that stage, whom I had met up again with again. And I got a job on the telephone exchange, and in due course all the chaps who were in this reception group had gone home and the reception camp was closing down. I got the drum that they needed some extra staff down at the Australian Army headquarters, which was in the Cumberland Hotel at Eastbourne right on the ocean front. And my mate, he got a job there as a transport driver, for which he was highly qualified because he had been a stockman on one of the cattle stations up north and he could ride a horse, so the army assumed that he could drive a truck apparently. And I got a job on the telephone exchange in this hotel where the administration staff were billeted, which was a good thing. It was a job that had to be manned 24 hours a day. And there were six of us to man this telephone exchange, and we soon worked out that between the hours of 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. there wasn't much going on. So we divided it into 12-hour shifts, which meant once you'd done a shift, you could vanish for several days and no one knew where you were. And this allowed us to have quite a bit of time roaming around, plus leave, which was rather liberal also. And this gave me an opportunity to see England and to meet all my relatives and generally fill a hole which had been in my life ever since I've been a kid.
What was your impression of the way the average Brit was coping with the post-war period, the immediate?
Well, the immediate post-war was obviously one of relaxation. You could feel the tension go out of the community. They were more relaxed. In fact, the short time that we were in Eastbourne, there was quite a few holiday makers were already being around the town, sitting around in the deck chairs the way the English do, and just generally relaxing. And there was also a wonderful feeling of fellowship between Australians and English, probably because of our ancestries. This made the whole episode in England very congenial.
I'm interested, because you're obviously in England by the time VE Day had taken place, but VJ or VP Day was to take place later on, obviously the 15th of August.
Mm.
What was the general feeling when that...
Well, you mustn't overlook the fact that we were soldiers and we had been engaged in the business of killing for about 4 or 5 years. And I recollect quite distinctly sitting down at a breakfast table with my mate, and we picked up the paper and there was this thing about an atomic bomb, and I recollect the words quite clearly. I said, "Gee, that must be a beaut." He says, "Yeah, must be a real trimmer. I've said it killed 75,000 people." "Yeah, tough, isn't it, eh?" "Yeah, she's tough, mate." And that is just about the effect that, as an individual, it had on me. But deep inside, I knew that our country would be safe, and that was a wonderful feeling. That lifted a lot, because we fully expected once we got back we would have to be involved in fighting the Japanese somehow. And this finished it all. And quite frankly, we didn't give a damn if the whole of the island was wiped out. But at that time, let me make it clear, we had no clear picture of the atrocities to which our fellow soldiers had been submitted in Japanese hands.
I'm interested to talk about that, because now there is peace throughout the world. How does that then affect you as an individual?
Well, I'm in a peculiar situation. As I may have told you, I'm the state president of the Ex-Prisoners of War Association. Roughly 80% of our members would have been Japanese prisoners of war. And I have to represent their point of view, and a lot of their hatred has passed on to me, and I can see the atrocities they went through. And I'm very conscious of the fact that if Japan had overrun this country, just what would have happened to us all.
But at the time, that may have been a concern, that the Japanese would overrun the country. I'm interested what the feeling was then, though, when you realised that the war, well, there was no war in the world now, from the 15th of August, 45.
Oh, well, we knew we would be going home and we'd have to start making a living for ourselves and getting on with the business of being alive.
What were your thoughts of what you'd like to do next?
Quite frankly, I never had a clear picture of it. You've got to remember this, I was locked up, many of us were locked up for quite some time. And the thing was to enjoy the moment. And I was enjoying the beauties of being free, of having a pay book full of dough, and I could do any damn thing I wanted practically, and I was enjoying this moment. And plus the fact that people were making quite a considerable fuss of us. Even in our own country, we were on terrific rations, and there was a canteen there where you could buy anything. And everything we wanted was freely available, readily available, and life was just damn good. And as far as getting home and getting on with the business of being alive, well, no, that didn't enter my head at that stage.
So you were eventually to leave. What was it like to leave England finally?
Not very easy for numerous reasons, which are obvious at this stage in my life, and they would have been obvious then. But I have, I'm sure, mentioned I had a fiancée in England, and we had discussed the topic of getting married. My mate, he married his girlfriend, who incidentally was my wife's girlfriend, and they still go out together some 56 years later. They're still going out shopping and so on. However, it wasn't easy leaving her behind, but we had decided that as I had been locked up for a damn long time and I needed to sort a lot of things out, it would probably be better if I went home and we could both have a good think about this, because the generation we come from regarded marriage as being a very important and thing which you didn't enter into very lightly. So leaving England was not a very happy experience, the actual leaving of England. Once we had left England, well, then you look ahead where you're going and what's happening next.
Well, tell us about that time. You're on the ship. What were the general thoughts, the general feelings that you had on board ship?
Well, we, again, an unusual situation. We came home on the Dominion Monarch, which had been stripped and made into a troop ship. you could see from one end of the ship to the other along the decks. Mess tables were right along these decks. There was quite a number of airmen and a few Australian officers, but a lot of Air Force officers going home. They all were up on the upper decks. There was 18 of us Australians going home. We had the whole troop ship to ourselves below decks until we got to the sewers. And they filled it up then with Kiwis who were coming home from the Middle East. And from there onwards, of course, it was ribald jocularity amongst the Kiwis and the little group of Australians that were left on this massive mess deck where there would be several thousand men. So that was...
It must have been a relaxed time you were having before you got the sewers.
Oh, yes, yes.
Your average day, how would you spend it?
Oh, just yarning, reading books, and there were a few English fellas going out to Aden, I think it was, in that general direction. There were fellas who had been conscripted, hadn't actually, I don't think they'd been in the war, they were the new army sort of thing, and they were going out as part of the system that was in vogue then. It was mainly maybe a few concerts with the Pommy blokes till we got to the sewers. When we got to sewers, we were not allowed ashore. We were anchored in the canal overnight or so to refuel, and we were a bit uptight about not going ashore. And there's one fellow, recollecting quite well, joker named Snowy Dewfall. He said, "I'm bloody well going ashore." So he stripped down to his shorts and went over the side, swam to the shore, climbed up onto the wharf where he was faced by a couple of Gippo soldiers with fixed bayonets, so he dropped back into the water and come back to the ship again. But he said, "At least I've been ashore at bloody Egypt." And then the Kiwis come on and we made our way down through the lakes out into the Red Sea and into the Indian Ocean that way. We came down the Indian Ocean, and at one stage we were listening to Swan District's play in the grand final. But we were out at sea and we finished up in New Zealand, which took a lot of handling, because not only with us, but at home, shipping news was now available. The Dominion Monarch was heading for Perth or Fremantle. My mother had gone to a lot of trouble to get a lovely meal for her little homecoming boy, and we finished up in New Zealand, which was it wasn't a heartbreaking thing for us. It was just damned inconvenient all around.
In relation to coming back home, what were some of the thoughts that you had of the future? The fact that you'd now been through this trying phase of your life, although an adventurous phase, what were the feelings about returning home?
Well, I knew that the firm I had worked for was obliged to take me back into its employment. That was part of the law of the land then. And beyond working for them, I'm afraid I never thought very much as far as my future career went. My main thoughts, being a young fellow and in love, was how I could settle down and get things organised for a married life more than anything else. And this job was part of the deal. And at that stage, all I ever wanted in life was a job, a house and a wife. And a couple of kids, maybe. I never thought beyond that. I had no ambitions about becoming a factory manager or anything of this nature. No, I just wanted a job and plod along day to day. It didn't happen that way, but that was that stage. Getting back to New Zealand, though.
I'm interested. Did you see WA at all before you whizzed off to New Zealand?
No, we were beyond the horizon, because WA's got a few reefs and islands and things out there, and we had to skirt all those. And no, we never saw any of WA until we got to in the Bass Strait, and we saw Lord Howe, Cape Howe, isn't it? Yeah, that's the southernmost point of Australia. Well, we passed that, and the Kiwis looked at it and said, "Why didn't you give it to the bloody Japs and let them starve to death?" So. So we got to New Zealand, we finished up back in Sydney, and there was a full-scale welcome there. It's very hard to describe even now without emotion. You must remember the Air Force chaps that were coming home had been fighter pilots, bomber pilots, and so on. They were part of a very important part of the war. Ferry Circle, our boat, and the whole of the wharf, or the quite a lot of the harbour side was loaded with people waving to us. We got into Darling Harbour, and there was bands playing, what have you. The Air Force Jokers went off, and one minute, there was a bit of a parade through Sydney in buses, nothing, down the main streets and then out to the showgrounds, where everyone was allocated tickets to get home. For example, the fellas up in Queensland, they were going the next day, fellas down to Victoria were going the day after that, and some brass says, "Oh, you West Australians, you pick up your gear and be on the bus, there's a ship leaving tonight." Well, there was five of us other ranks and two officers of our 2nd 11th Battalion. Well, we bucked about this, said the officers, and they approached the brass and explained the situation. So we got 5 days leave, and of course I promptly got on the train and went down to Newcastle, as I've related earlier in this tape, that we had met people there who had looked after us. And then I came back to Sydney. A thing I have overlooked here, though, was when we were dispersed from Sydney showgrounds, there was my eldest sister with her two babies to visit me, and I never even knew they were in Sydney, and that was a wonderful thrill too. We travelled by ship back to Perth. We arrived in Fremantle, and there was a big crowd there, of course, but none of my relatives, I couldn't understand this, but we were all put in a bus and taken out to Claremont Showgrounds, and there was my mother and my sister. They were there. They had been selected and taken there.
So I'm interested that you sort of talk about this whole period as a fairly...
compact.
Yeah, well, was the impression I get is that you went away to war, and you just came back, and you went to all these places, and then you're back in Fremantle. What were your impressions in relation to seeing Fremantle after all of this time?
Oh, well, it was very, very emotional, but very joyful. Yeah, joyful would be the word that I think would apply to it. Because when going, you recollect we were stuck out in gauge roads out from Fremantle for a couple of days, and we used to look at the shore and we say, well, the next time you see it's going to be very important. And this was. Fremantle, of course, looked drab. Well, there'd been a war on all this time. There hadn't been much paint thrown around. We could hear trams going up and down the streets long before we got into the harbour. And there were not many boats came out to see us, probably because there wasn't fuel available and things of this nature. There was still under the control of rationing as far as fuel went.
For a lot of chaps, they'd never actually see Fremantle again. What did it mean to you to be one of the few that had?
Yes, well, of course, the things that happen to men are always going to happen to the other chap. You never think they're going to happen to you. But, yes, yeah, so I did feel a bit there. But mind you, you're asking me to think back, 56 years. It's a bit, the exact feelings are a little hard to recall. But I do know I'm an emotional sort of a character, and it did certainly get to me emotionally, yes. But there was only five of us on the ship. I must give me a jip. With two officers, and we're all from the one battalion. We'd known each other for many years. And just to be in their company was good. And, of course, I've been in their company until they've all passed away and so on. So that's how solid friendships were in those days. But Fremantle itself, well, there had been...
Untouched by the war, or certainly untouched by the war that you'd seen anyway.
Yes, as far as damage went, it was looking a bit run down, of course. Everywhere in Australia looked a bit run down by the end of the war. But there had been no building going on, no rearrangement of traffic, and there was, well, traffic was down to a minimum in those days. So there was nothing startling in Fremantle's appearance at all, because it wasn't until the America's Cup that the Fremantle lifted itself up from where it was, and it was at a, well, just a ramshackle sort of a city down on the coast there for the fishermen.
Your impression of coming back to WA, obviously a place untouched by the war as you'd seen it. Mm. But what was it like to be returning back to a place that hadn't been really touched?
Oh, it was, well, because Perth was the hometown, and it was a very remarkable experience, in as much that I'd be talking about something we took before the war and naming streets and what have you, and my sister would look at me for a while and try and work out where I was, and then she'd tell me that I got the names of the streets all wrong and that I had forgotten where they all went. So these were one of the things, and often I'd be out walking and suddenly there's a building that I'd forgotten about, or a scene, little things like that that kept catching on. And one thing that did remember quite clearly, when you get into the city of Perth on a hot summer's day, this was before the reclamation of the Swan River, there used to be a big mud flat there. None of the buildings had air conditioning. The air conditioning meant opening your windows when the Fremantle doctor came in from the south, and it came in across that stinking mud flat, and the whole of the city had a peculiar perfume which could only exist in Perth.
I'm interested that you talk about coming back to Perth, and I'm particularly interested in how you would cope with civilian life.
Well, it wasn't that easy. Well, I was pushed around from pillar to post. In the first place, the firm took me back, yes. They were completing some small boats. Actually, they were water lighters. They call them ships for carrying water. Down at Fremantle, only comparatively small boats. They still had two of them to finish. Contracts had to be done. They were still working shift work down there. And I was sent down to Fremantle on the job there as a timekeeper and storeman and what have you. This didn't please me very much, working shift work, but it was a job. And so in due course, I wanted to become a tradesman, and you were entitled to become a tradesman under the post-war rehabilitation scheme. I applied for a boilermaker's job. A boilermaker, not necessarily making boilers, it means marking out steel and shaping it and generally putting structures together for riveters or welders to complete the job. But you were the man who read the blueprints, marked out the steel and put it together. So I finish up, you're interviewed by different people. Yes, as far as the government concerned, I was entitled to be considered. I finish up before some chappie who was a staunch member of the union fraternity, and they didn't want anything to do with us because our apprenticeship was over a period of 2 years, and of course we were all over 25 years of age then. And they didn't approve of a 2-year apprenticeship, and they threw up a lot of objections. The objection this bloke brought up was that I was not employed in that category in the services, and according to the Act, that's how it was, and he's very sorry, he couldn't do anything about it. So I asked him then about a boilermaker's welder, which is the chap that does the welding on the jobs. And well, he said the same would apply, and of course I'd woken up to this character by now. Oh no, I was working with welders in Germany, and he asked me if I could get stat decks to that effect. Well, fortunately I was working with welders occasionally in Munich, and I got the stat decks. I got an apprenticeship as a boilermaker's welder, which, well, it did the job. I got through my apprenticeship all right, finished up with my trade a couple of years later. But it was not a very enjoyable experience. Certain tradesmen did not want anything to do with us because we were getting it cushy. Being a welder, you are sitting there working or crouch welding with a hood over your head all the time. and all the things that you had been through over the past 5 years come crowding in, and you take your helmet off and just sit down to shake your head for a minute. And that's when I got my first bit of post-war counselling. The foreman come along and said, get on with the bloody job, will you? You're not paid to sit on your ass all day. And that's how it was. We had to get on with our living. We were not counselled. Probably it was there, but we didn't know about it. I didn't know about it.
People talk of this post-traumatic stress disorder that's now given for that sort of thing. And you mentioned that your mates were important.
Oh, yes. Yes, well, I still... We enlisted from Perth, just about that whole battalion. Not a big percentage of the battalion enlisted from Perth. There were also members from the country, from the goldfields and so on, to make up the 2nd and 11th City of Perth Battalion.
So it was then that you could turn to when you came back?
Oh, yes. You'd get together with your mates, yarn over things, and they're all in pretty much the same boat. The idealistic attitude was not a reality.
I'm interested because people come home and describe the fact that you couldn't really tell anyone about your experience other than your mates.
Hmm. Well, it's true, you couldn't, because they'd heard all before, read it in the papers, and it was all something that happened to someone else anyway. But we didn't talk about that's so much amongst your mates when you got together. It was just being together. You talk about anything. You've been mates for years and tough times.
Well, a lot of people that I've interviewed have never told their stories up until now. Why do you think that is?
Well, a sense of disinterest amongst the listener, for one thing. Also, I do think a lot of the men regard it as something being in the past, and you've got to get on with what's in the future if you're going to make a go of life. That has been my attitude. I've never hesitated to talk about the war to people who wanted to know about it, but I've never made it an opening topic in any conversation.
I also understand that people wouldn't really have been able to fathom your experience anyway.
No.
Was that, in a way, one of the reasons you didn't bother telling?
Oh, yes, for sure. How can you tell them what happens to a fellow when he's shot or when a bit of his leg's blown off? He'd explain all that to someone who's sitting by a fireside listening to the radio while you're talking to them. It's just not there. And you realise after a while that people aren't really interested. They just aren't.
Those people that obviously did come back and are around today, I get the impression that there was the attitude that they had adopted on their return. And you mentioned leaving it in the past. Has it been difficult to leave in the past?
Yes, because it keeps cropping up. Again, the situation I'm in with the ex-prisoners of war. There's a hell of a lot of do-gooders around. And the men that I am obliged to represent are not going to forget what happened. And they will never, ever forgive the brutality, the atrocities, the murder. And the do-gooders have never seen it. They've got no idea. They think there's a great hand going to come out of the sky and everything will be fine. And yet we can see at this day, the date you quoted on that tape, what the hell's going on? Here we are again, getting all ready to start her off. How do you explain that to the do-gooders? We can't forget it.
I'm interested that you mentioned that. I mean, obviously, here we are to start things off again. World War One, the war to end all wars. World War Two.
Yes, that's right.
What was it?
Yes, well, we brought World War Two upon ourselves a lot with the Treaty of Versailles. I mean, if you study history a bit, that's rather obvious. And that is the lever that Hitler used to get into power, the impositions of that treaty. And I think any nation in his position would have done the same.
What do you see World War II achieved, if you look at what we're facing now?
Nothing. Nothing. Because every country is just how it was before World War II. But where the difference is, the countries which were once colonies and policed and occupied by Britain in particular are now free, and this is this is one of the problems that they're trying to expand themselves. But unfortunately, and this is my opinion, the men at the head are as evil as Adolf Hitler and his cronies, and we put up with them for too damn long. And we've got the same problem again.